go home about 5 pounds heavier than when I came, but the rate I'm going, I may have to revise that upward. Everyone is just going out of their way almost to make sure that I get plenty to eat, and it's enjoyable. And you got a lot of good cooks over here. Of course, I've noticed that wherever I go and hold meetings. It seems like I don't think it's a qualification for you ladies to be a good cook nor be a Christian, but it seems like most of you are. And I'm really enjoying it, and the time that I'm being able to spend with you in your homes and getting to know you, I think all of that is important to me. Someone asked me if I was getting homesick. I said, well, yes and no. Things are breaking down at home, so when I go home, I got to start working on things. But a few things have broken down. That seems like the way it goes whenever I leave home. Just almost from the time I pull out of the driveway, something determines itself to break during the week. So maybe I can get back before anything really major goes wrong. I don't want my wife to think that she can live without me. I've been working on that for 25 years, almost 26 years. So I think I got her convinced she needs me. Tonight I want to talk to you about basically one verse of Scripture found in the 5th chapter of Matthew, verse 41. And whoever shall, if you're in the King James Version, it says, whosoever shall or compelleth thee to go a mile, go with him twain. The New American Standard, which I read from here, says, whoever shall force you to go 1 mile, go with him two. And I believe that any one of us can understand that, regardless of which translation we're looking at. But I would suggest to you that to the listeners of those words, as Jesus spoke them, that was something revolutionary and something that would not have been something that went down very easy for them. This would have been a hard commandment for his original audience. We'll talk about that in just a moment. The Sermon on the Mount, in fact, as we refer to it, Jesus didn't say, I'm about to deliver the Sermon on the Mount. But the fact is, of course, he went up in on a mountain and sat down, verse 1 of that 5th chapter says. So logically, it has become known as the Sermon on the Mount. It was revolutionary teaching. Many people view it as Jesus making a comparison of the law of Moses with his law. And it's not so much that as it is a comparison very often of what they had been told about the law of Moses and Jesus' law. He says, here's what I say unto you. Because many of the things they had been told and commonly taught and were expected to accept as the truth really was not exactly what the law said. But it was revolutionary. Even the application of this one verse, verse 41, if it alone were adopted by even a majority of people in the world, in this nation, in this state, in the community, even in this church, things would just get turned upside down. Whoever compels you to go a mile, go with him too. Little boy one time asked to recite it in Bible class, and they had learned it in the King James. Whosoever compelleth thee to go a mile, go with him twain. Teacher said, can anybody recite that? He raised his hands. She said, all right, go ahead. He said, whoever compels you to go a mile, go with him by train. Well, he was a little bit off, wasn't he? Sounded pretty close. And it'd been a lot easier if you could go by train. But it calls upon us to do something beyond what is expected of us. And that really is the gist of this verse. Like repentance is a hard command. You know, it's hard to repent. Not impossible, but it's hard. Because in repentance, we have to tell ourselves, I have been wrong. I've been going in the wrong direction, and I'm going to have to turn around. And we don't like to turn around. We don't like to admit that we've been wrong. But Jesus said, whoever compels you to go a mile, go with him twain. Which of these 2 miles do you believe would be easier? The first one or the second one? You're being compelled to go 1 mile. Jesus says, don't stop there, go a second mile. Well, the first one obviously is one of compulsion. It's one of law, it's dictated, you go a mile. The second one is by love. And so the lesson tonight is entitled, The Love Mile. The setting, of course, is the Sermon on the Mount, as I already mentioned. And it sets forth in those early verses how a person can be prepared for the kingdom and be happy. Blessed are the poor in spirit, verse 3, theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. And this is not mourning over the loss of a loved one. This is mourning over one's own condition before God, having sinned in the sight of God. Until somebody begins to mourn over that and really sorrow over what they've done in violating the law of God, they won't appreciate the benefit of forgiveness to be found in Jesus Christ when they are then added into the church or the kingdom. And on he goes down through those verses and says, happy or blessed are such people if they do this. And then we come on down to the verses immediately surrounding this one. And he begins to talk about some obligations. Verse 40, if anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, let him have your coat also. That would have seemed strange, wouldn't it? I've never been taken to court. It would seem strange that if someone is taking me to court for, let's say, $1,000, and the judge enters a judgment in favor of the other person, I say, here, take $2,000. That seems revolutionary. It's just not normally done. Jesus said, whoever forces you to go a mile, go with him two. We have to know a little background of this. Nobody comes along in our society, or at least not in West Lafayette, and compels me to go a mile. But the Romans had the authority to compel a Jew to help them carry some burden for 1 mile. That's what the law said. And so if you were compelled to do that and you heard what Jesus said, you already despised that requirement. You didn't want to carry it 1 mile. And here somebody comes along sitting up on the mountainside and telling you that if they ask you to go a mile, you go 2 miles. You can almost imagine somebody sitting toward the back of the crowd saying, what did he say? Did I hear that right? Did he say, if they make us go a mile, we're supposed to go another mile? Yeah, that's what he said. As revolutionary. They absolutely despise that requirement. So apparently what many Jews would do, at least out in front of their property, they'd drive a peg down in the road. They'd measure off a mile. And they'd drive another one. And so that at least if they were out in front of their house and a Roman soldier came along and said, hey, carry this. They would pick it up, put it on their back, carry it for a mile and drop it. Because that's what the law said. And here Jesus comes along and says, go a second mile. Of course, if they ever did that, nobody would be any more surprised than the Roman soldier, probably. Revolutionary teaching, and that's what this is all about. These folks, in order to be prepared for the kingdom of heaven, in many cases were going to have to revolutionize their whole way of thinking. And that's what he was getting at. Unfortunately, like a lot of these Jews, we end up living by the peg in the road. We figure out what we have to do in life, in a lot of different relationships, and we don't do any more than that. And Jesus is saying, whoever compels you to go a mile, go two. There has to be some application of this verse. There's not a direct application. As I said, I don't think it happens over here either. Our government does not allow a government official to come along and make us carry something for a mile, at least not yet. Who knows what the future holds? But they were required to do that. Well, what then is the general application of the passage? Was not Jesus saying to them, you do what people have a right, and in this case a legal right, to expect of you, and then some? What it seemed to be saying. Go beyond what is required of you. There was a millionaire one time. He retired at age 37. I'm not going to make it. I'm past 37. Now, some of you young people up here, you haven't got that far yet. Don't make that your goal, though. That's a pitiful goal, to be a millionaire. Nothing wrong with being a millionaire, but don't make that your goal. And they asked him, well, how are you able to retire so young? He said, well, back when I was in school, said, I did everything the teachers required of me, and then some. And as a result, he said, I graduated at the top of my high school class. And I went off to college, and I was able to get into a pretty good college because of my grades. And I did everything the professors there required of me, and then some. And I graduated top of my class. Because I graduated at the top of my class, I was able to interview with the best companies and received a good position with the company. And I started out and I kept the same philosophy. I did everything that was required of me and then some. And pretty soon I rose to the top of the company and pretty soon I owned the company. Because he did everything that was required of him and then some. Now that principle really is in this passage. And what I want to do tonight is to see how that principle, if it applied in our life, will make a difference. Because, as I said, too many of us end up living by the peg in the road. We decide what our obligation is in some area of life, in some relationship, and we do that, and that's all. And we end up, in the process of that, cutting other people off, cutting them short. And really, we're not happy ourselves sometimes, because we know we ought not be doing that, but we do it anyway. The lesson of this verse is that we can make a difference in the lives of other people, and we are supposed to do that anyway. Philippians, the second chapter, talks to us, of course, about being an example. Philippians chapter 2, verses 14 and 15. Here we live in the midst of darkness, as Paul talks about it here, and that's true in our generation as well as his. But he says, do all things without grumbling or disputing. Does that characterize you and me? I have to confess, that doesn't always characterize me. Grumbling, disputing. That you may prove yourselves to be blameless and innocent, children of God above reproach in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you appear as lights in the world. People have a tendency to say, well, what difference can I make? I'm just one person. This passage says you can make a difference. That even though you're surrounded by darkness, you can be a light. Holding fast the word of life so that in the day of Christ, he says, I may have cause to glory because I didn't run in vain or toil in vain. And again, we're reminded of Matthew, the 5th chapter, verse 13, where he said, you're the salt of the earth. Then in verse 16, you're the light of the world. We are here to make a difference in the lives of other people. But too often we are content to do what is expected of us, to go that first mile, but not even think about the second mile. Which means too often we're content to just be average. And I mentioned, I think, Sunday, that the only problem with being average is you're close to the bottom as you are the top. In some subjects in school, I was average, and I was glad I could get that far up. But I look back, and a lot of times I could have done better. I just didn't try very hard. People have a right to expect out of us certain things, but Jesus tells us in this passage, in principle, you go beyond that. And it's a lot easier for me to stand up here and talk to you about this than it is for me to practice it. I guarantee you that. The Jews, of course, were probably repulsed, some of them, by what he said here. As I said, they hated that requirement. Of course, they despised the Romans dominating them anyway, and they longed for someone to come along and free them of that. And they thought Jesus was the one, and when he wasn't, they weren't interested in him. He didn't have that kind of mission. I want to talk to you how this applies to the family. The love model. We've already seen basically the general application of it and how that it's harder to live it and talk about it. But I'd like to ask, for example, where is this practice the least, this business of going the second mile? Where is it, if anything, we're apt to do things without grumbling, as Paul said. When we come together like this, when you come in the back door, if one of the elders asks you to, go back here in the classroom and get something for them or to do something, how many of us would grumble at them right there? Well, I don't want to do that. Get somebody else to do that. Not very likely, is it? Or one of the deacons or just anybody here. You know, if you come up and say, listen, I forgot something back there. I'm in a hurry. Would you go get it for me? Most of us would say, well, yeah, here, I'll go get it. We wouldn't even think of grumbling. That's because when we come here, we've put on our happy face, we've got our Sunday go to meeting clothes on, and we want everybody to really, you know, we're trying to really put on a good image when we're here. I'm not saying we're all hypocrites now. I'm just saying that we'll sort of go out of our way to, you know, even if we just had a terrible argument with our wife out there in the parking lot. I mean, it's a rip-roaring argument over something. You know, husbands, do we start most of them? Yeah, it doesn't matter. But you've had an argument out there, and time you come in these doors back here, though. Oh, hi, how you doing? Oh, pretty good. My mind, you just really had it out with your wife or your husband. Or you're having an argument at home, and the phone rings. You're right in the middle of a sentence. You're telling your wife or your husband something really bad, and all, hello? Yeah, we do that. We all do that. We can identify with that. So when we are out here among other people, we're you know, our behavior's a little bit better most of the time. And once in a while, the raw edges are showing, and other people get a glimpse of us. But I'll tell you what, if we ever show those rough edges, most of the time, where do we show them? At home. So where is this passage applied most of the time? To the very least degree, in our homes. Whoever shall force you to go a mile, go with him too. I think we have a problem applying this at home worse than any place else. As a matter of fact, truth of the matter is, we sometimes will end up treating total strangers better than we do our family. You think, well, I don't do that. Well, let me see. This ever happened? How many of you dads have a favorite chair? And that's your chair. That's your lazy boy. And I mean, everybody in that household knows that's Dad's chair. And when Dad gets in from work, that chair better be empty. You don't mind too much if somebody sits in it during the day. But when he gets home from work and whatever he does after he gets home, when he's ready for that chair, it better be empty. And if somebody gets in there when he wants in there, they hear about it. What are you doing in my chair? I'm tired. I've worked all day. Go sit somewhere else. Now, on the other hand, Dad gets that chair after running out his son or somebody and doorbell rings. It's a salesman of some kind. Happens to be that you're interested in what he's got to say, and you invite him. Yeah, come on in here. Here's a good chair. Let him sit right down in your favorite chair. Here's a total stranger that gets a little better treatment than our own family does. Man, that's just an illustration. But things like that go on in our home. The frightening thing about it is our children grow up being about like we are. How many of you parents, when you get really frustrated at your children over something, but then you begin to reflect on it later and you realize, I know where they got that from. No, not your wife, not your husband. They get that from me. That's the way I am. We won't tolerate it in our children. Of course, we overlook it in ourselves. And so we end up being much harder on our children. That's not going to work. I need about a half a page now. That'll be a little better if it falls off. Who cares? So we end up treating total strangers sometimes better than we do our parents. I want to suggest to you that if we will apply Matthew 5 and verse 41, we can improve our marriages. Imagine that. There are certain obligations that husbands have toward their wives. Of course, I mentioned last night, 1 Corinthians 7, verses 1 through 5. Tonight I'd like to go to Ephesians chapter 5. These are not new. Everybody here is familiar with them. These are things that Paul, in no uncertain terms, says that husbands have to do. In verse 25, he says, "Husbands, love your wives." And that word love means that a husband is to seek what is in the best interest of his wife. Interestingly enough, nowhere in the New Testament is the word for love that has to do with affection. We sometimes think of brotherly love. Now you check me on this, but I believe I'm right about it. Nowhere is that word applied to the husband toward his wife. Now, that doesn't mean that we should not show affection toward our wife and everything, because if we have this kind of love for them, then we're going to do what is in their best interest, and we'll know that they need this emotional love that the Bible does talk about, and so we're going to be giving that to them. But it's just interesting that that is the case. Husbands, love your wives. Now, I don't mean to indicate this, that a fellow should go around with the attitude saying, "Well, I don't want to, but I guess I love my wife." No, don't think of it as a chore like that. But the fact is, he says, love your wives, and he says to do it in a certain way, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for her. Husbands, be willing to sacrifice for your wives. That's what he says. You love her. You put her first. You put her interest and heart. You keep on reading. He says in verse 28, love your husbands again. He says, you ought also love your own wives as your own bodies. How many people, but specifically here men, how many men pretty well take care of the things that they want to do and the things that they like? Well, most of us do a pretty good job of that. Well, he said, you love your own wife as you do yourself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it as Christ does the church. And then verse 33, nevertheless, let each individual among you also love his own wife even as himself. Now, those are obligations that we have that we can't get around. That's what we are to do toward our wives. And you can go back through there, and wives have some obligation to their husbands. Verse 22, be subject to your own husbands as to the Lord. The matter of subjection. Then again, verse 24, as the church is subject to Christ, so also the wives ought to be to their husbands in everything. Then again, we continue to look at the total picture here, and we come down to the conclusion of this. Verse 33, nevertheless, of course he says the mystery is great, I speak concerning Christ and the church, but nevertheless, let each individual among you also love his own wife, even as himself, and let the wife see to it that she respect her husband. Now, obviously, these obligations can be carried out more easily when both partners are working at it and working hard at it. That's why I talked about that last night and gave you a checklist of some things for you to go over when you're considering a husband or wife, a future husband, future wife. And if you begin to see things, then don't marry that kind of person. I didn't really go into that in great detail last night, but I do not take the position that it's a sin for a Christian to marry a non-Christian. It's about one of the most unwise things that you can ever do. But be that as it may, that's another discussion. But you're going to have to end up with these obligations toward them, so you better try to make the best choice you can. Sometimes one party doesn't want to fulfill their obligations. Well, they're still there. So we need to do what is expected, though, husbands, for our wives. But now let's bring Matthew 5:41 into it. And then some. And wives, you need to do what is expected of you toward your husband. And then some. Here's why. 1 mile service. If all we do toward our wife is what is expected of us, you can just about be guaranteed what you're going to get in return. About all they'll do in return is what they are obligated to do for you. In other words, if you give out 1 mile service, you'll probably get 1 mile service in return. Now here's a scenario for you. Husband comes downstairs on Monday morning, running late. Goes to button his coat and the button comes off. The wife's over there at the sink. She's all frazzled looking. got on Old Blue. You know what Old Blue is? And he says, oh my, he says, I popped my button. About like mine, they won't come together. I popped my button. Can you sew it on? You think that's all I got to do is sew buttons on for you? And she really rips into him and says, why didn't you let me know that button was loose? Well, you know, I can identify with that. There's times I forget to tell my wife it's loose. And sure enough, it comes off at the most inconvenient time. And she goes into that tirade about that. Now, all while she's doing that, she intends to sew that button on for him. But she makes him feel about that high. Well, give me that coat. I'll go sew it on. And she sews it on. And then she throws the coat at him. Now, get on out of here and leave me alone. I'm busy. Well, of course, you know, he goes on out the door, wounded. He goes away and he thinks, I believe I married the devil's sister. He's really feeling pretty low. And worse than that, he gets to the office and there's that secretary in the office. She really is really all, of course, dressed up and pretty for work. And he thinks back, his wife's over there at the sink in Old Blue. And he's having a rough week and his boss chews him out. During the week, things aren't going too well. And later in the week, he comes down to go to work, and his wife says, I kind of overspent this week. I'm going to need a little money, more money for groceries. I'm going to have to go pick up, you think. More money? You think money grows on trees? And he's got a tirade he goes into on money. Now, all the while, he intends to give her the extra money she needs. But because he knows he's obligated to do that. There's a mile he has to go. And so he gets through with his little lecture to her. And then, here's the money. Here it is. He goes off on to work. That's 1 mile service. And all he got in return was 1 mile service. All she gave was 1 mile service. And all she got in return was 1 mile service. That's the way a lot of marriages are. People just doing what is expected of them in the marriage relationship, and that's as far as it goes. And it's no wonder, then, that that little secretary at the office looks nicer all the time. And she understands him better than his wife does, and she doesn't fix herself up anymore. She just lets herself go, and the husband do the same thing. In fact, a whole lot of us husbands really are clods anyway. I'd like to think after 25 years of marriage, I'm maybe only a half a clod now. But you see, that works both ways, and marriages are terrible. People are just unhappy as can be. Now imagine if, instead of as I painted that, it goes a different way. And here that husband comes down the stairs, and that button comes off, and he says, oh my, he said, my button come off my coat. Why, she said, here, let me sew that on for you. Here, have another cup of coffee. Let me pour that for you, and you just sit there and enjoy another cup of coffee, and I'll get that button sewed on. And she sews that on and says, here, I got it done. And she puts his coat on for him and pats him on his tummy and says, now go get him, Tiger. And man, he walks out the door that way, see, and he thinks, boy, I married an angel. Later on in the week, she's running out of money. And she says, I don't know what happened, but I ran out of money. I need another $20. He said, you know, I don't understand how in the world you're able to stretch the money around here as far as you do. She said, I don't know how you do it. It's amazing. You get more bought around here for the money we seem to operate on. He says, it's incredible. Here's 40. Now, what made the difference there? Well, it was 2 mile service, and that ended up begetting 2 mile service. Now, that's the principle Jesus was talking about. If you're compelled to go a mile, go 2 miles. I just think what would happen in our marriages if we began to practice that. If we actually did what was expected of us in marriage and then some, well, our marriages would just have to improve. We'd be happier people. Our homes would be a happier place. Our children would be much more at ease. They wouldn't see us fussing and fighting and just doing what we have to for one another. They would see us smiling at each other and getting along, and they'd see us sneaking a kiss here and there and smooching, and they see that, and it makes a difference. It really does. Some of my fondest memories of childhood are coming around the corner into the kitchen, and there's Mom and Dad, even though they'd been married several years by the time I was a kid, old enough to pay attention to that, they're still kissing each other. After my wife and I had been married about 12 years, she's developing some severe sinus problems. She went to a specialist about it. And she says, I got to have some relief from this. She says, I can't even kiss my husband because I can't breathe through my nose. He says, how long you been married? Oh, 12 years. He said, most time after 12 years, wives don't care if they kiss their husband. You know, that's the truth. Now, that particular doctor, the rest of the story on him was he had a wife and a girlfriend. So he was doing a lot of kissing. But you know, that is true. There are a lot of married couples by that many years, sometimes it didn't even take that long. They don't have much relationship left. And a lot of times it's because they really never determined to do anything for each other except what they have to do. That 1 mile service. And that's all they get in return. So you see, we could improve our family life drastically if we would just begin to practice this going the second mile. And, of course, same thing be true of our children. There, you can go the second mile with them, too. It seems like a struggle sometimes as we train our children to just get them to do what we know they should do. You know, and they getting them to keep their room picked up and straightened up and things in place. And you know, you're trying to train them because someday somebody's got to pick that up. You're not going to be around to pick it up. Somebody's got to have to pick that up. You try to train them to do things like that. And those are small things, but they're fairly important. And once in a while, you go by your kid's room and it's all straightened up and you hadn't even told them. Well, that's pretty nice. Tell them about it. Compliment about that. Well, I appreciate you doing that. Didn't even have to say anything. But we could begin to put this into practice and our family life would be revolutionized. But I tell you what, we need to put this in the church too. Too often in the church, that thing's getting kind of curled up. I better take that off of there. Too often in the church, it's the same kind of thing. We begrudgingly go about our duties as children of God, and it ought not be that way. We could improve the family life when the family's thought of as the church if we just practice Matthew 5:41. Do what is expected of us and then some. I conducted an experiment one place I preached. A couple light bulbs went out in one hallway down in the basement of the church. Of course, I noticed it because every day I went in and out of there. And I decided I'm going to wait and see if anybody notices that and says anything about it. Well, quite a time went by and finally someone noticed it. They didn't do anything about it except come to me and said, Larry, didn't you know those bulbs were out? Well, I knew it weeks before that. Now, what's wrong with somebody coming into a building like that, noticing a light bulb is out and going and getting one, putting it in? Why does somebody have to wait to be told, go put that light bulb in? You see how we could just improve things, and that's a silly example, but I hope it makes the point. Do what is expected of us, and then some. When something needs to be done, just pick it up and do it. Things like that go on all the time. But a lot of times in the church, we're not content to do that because we don't get any attention for that. No one gives us any praise. If we just change the light bulb, nobody knows who changed it. Forget who was it said you can get a whole lot more done when you don't care who gets the credit. We get too concerned in the church about who's going to get credit for something. And we end up becoming envious of one another because it looks like somebody's getting more credit than we are. That's not 2 mile service. That's seeking the praise of men. And Jesus made it pretty plain. If all we want is the praise of men, then we'll get that in this life. We better enjoy it because that's all there is. We need to be servants of each other and begin to see ourselves not as someone to sit back and be served, but someone that is going to give that 2 mile service to somebody else. Whosoever compelleth thee to go a mile, go with him twain. 2 mile service. If that were practiced, if we would really put into practice, of course, what Jesus was teaching there, we could revolutionize things. We'd end up being a better teacher, whatever it is you do in life, a nurse, whatever it is you do, you'd be the best there is. And our family lives would improve, and our relationships in the church would improve, because we're going to go out of our way to do everything we can, and then some. The world desperately needs to see examples of happy, loving families, because there are so many out there that are broken all to pieces. They don't even know what it's like. There are fewer and fewer people growing up in the kind of family that I came from. A mom and dad who loved each other, who sacrificed for their children, who kept all seven of us fed and clothed, who went without things that they needed and maybe wanted so that their kids could get something they wanted. Now, you don't recognize that, kids, when you're growing up. You want a new pair of shoes or a new pair of pants or something like that, and you end up getting them, and you don't even stop to notice that Mom had to keep on wearing that same dress a little bit longer because there wasn't enough money to do both of them. And your parents love you and they sacrifice for you. And they try to make family life as good as they can. People out in the world, folks, they're not seeing that anymore. They don't come from those kind of circumstances. So it's important that we develop our families that way. And when they come over to our home and they can see how that we interact with one another and that we serve each other in that family, it'll have an impression on them. It might make them feel bad because they don't have that kind of home, but just maybe they'll be interested someday in making sure that they develop a home like that. If you're here tonight and you're not a child of God, then there's a family that you need to become a part of tonight, and that's God's family. I'm sure that all things are ready for you to become a Christian, to have your sins forgiven, washed away in the blood of the Lamb. And if you've done that and you need to be forgiven of a sin that you have committed as a child of God and it's of such a nature that it needs to be confessed publicly, then use this opportunity. It may be that it's your last one. It may be that you'll have others. We don't know. We pray, though, that you'll do what you need to do to be right with God as we stand and we sing together.